He saw the road ahead, and a fence, rotten wood posts with three widely spaced lines of rusting barbed wire strung through them. The parachute inflated yet again, hauling him into the air. He lifted his knees almost to his chest and was carried right over the lines. Aubrey put his feet down in a ditch on the other side, stumbled, and was remorselessly dragged out into the highway. He reached around behind him, grasping wildly for the carabiners on the back of his harness. He unclasped one, a second. The road burned his knees through his jumpsuit. He leapt up, did a hopping jig, found a third clip, snapped it free. He twisted from the waist, feeling for the last. It sprang loose all of a sudden, and Aubrey was thrown onto his chest across the dotted yellow line. He lifted his head and watched as the gay ruin of his parachute was sucked into the crown of an enormous oak across the street. Immediately it collapsed, draping itself upon the branches. Aubrey turned over. He ached in the small of his back, in his knees. His throat was sandpaper dry. He gazed into the bright, hard blue, searching for his cloud, and there it was, a great white hubcap, barely indistinguishable from the other fat, puffy scraps of cloud up there. It still looked like a mothership, just as Harriet had said. Harriet had said it was a UFO, and she'd been right. He felt an inexplicable throb of affection for it, for the home his Sky Harriet had tried to make for him there. He felt, in some ways, that he was still gently floating to Earth. He might be floating like this for days. He was yet on his back in the road when a guy in a black Cadillac rolled down the highway from the north, slowing as he approached, then steering a wide berth around Aubrey. The caddy stopped right next to him. The driver, an old man with angry blue eyes under a thicket of storm cloud-colored eyebrows, powered down his window. "Fuck you doing in the road? Someone go right over you, asshole." Aubrey, unoffended, sat up on his elbows. "Hey, mister, where is this? Am I in Pennsylvania?" The driver glared, his lean face darkening, as if Aubrey were the one who had called him an asshole. "What kind of drugs you on? I ought to call the cops." "So, not Pennsylvania? Try New Hampshire." "Huh. No kidding." Aubrey wasn't sure he could get out of the road just yet. It was awfully nice here, warm black top beneath his back, sun glowing on his face. He was in no rush to get to whatever was next. "Jesus," the old bird said, spittle flying from his lips. "Get your head out of the clouds." "Just did," Aubrey said. The old guy powered his window back up and got out of there. Aubrey turned his head to watch him go. When he had the highway to himself, he got to his feet, dusted off his rear, and began to walk. From above, he had seen a farmhouse not too far away. If anyone was home, he thought he'd ask to use their phone. He figured his mother might like to know he was alive.
Rain. When the rain fell, most everyone was caught outside in it. You wonder maybe why so many people died in that initial downpour. People who weren't there say, "Don't folks in Boulder know to come in out of the rain?" Well, let me tell you. This was the last Friday in August, you remember, and it was H.O.T. hot. At 11 in the morning, there wasn't a cloud to be seen. The sky was so blue it hurt to look at it for too long, and a body just couldn't stand to be inside. It was about as glorious as the first day in Eden. Seemed like everyone found something to do out of doors. Mr. Waldman, who was the first to die, was up on his roof, banging a hammer on new shingles. He had his shirt off, and his skinny old man's back was baked as red as a boiled crab, but he didn't seem to mind. Martina, the Russian stripper who lived in the apartment below mine, was out in our dusty scrap of yard, sunning herself in a black bikini so tiny it felt like you ought to have to feed a machine quarters to keep looking at her. The windows were all open in the big decaying colonial next door, where the Comet cult people lived, Elder Bend and his family of broken wackadoodles. Three of their women were outside in the silver gowns they all wore, ceremonial hubcaps on their heads. One of them, an obese gal with a sad, vacant grapefruit of a face, was turning sausages on the grill, and the blue smoke carried down the street, making folks hungry. The other two were at the wooden lawn table working on a fruit salad. one of them chopping pineapple and the other picking red seeds out of pomegranates. Me? I was killing time with little Dracula and waiting on the person I loved most in the world. Yolanda was driving up from Denver with her mother. Yolanda was moving in with me. Little Dracula was a boy named Templeton Blake, who lived across the street from me, next door to Mr. Waldman. Yolanda and I both looked after the kid sometimes for his mother, Ursula, who was on her own after her husband had died the year before. Ursula tried to pay us sometimes, but usually we could convince her to settle up with some other form of compensation, a few slices of pizza or fresh vegetables from her garden. I felt sorry for them. Ursula was a slender, small, gracious dame who suffered from mild haphophobia. She couldn't bear to be touched, which made you wonder how she'd ever had a kid. Her 9-year-old had the vocabulary of a 40-year-old sociologist and almost never left the house. He was always sick with one thing or another, on a raft of antibiotics or antihistamines. The day the first rain fell, he was being treated for recurring strep and couldn't go outside because his medicine had made him hypersensitive to sunlight. A lot of healthy, vigorous children died in Boulder that day. Parents all over town booted their kids outside to whoop it up on one of the last, most brilliant days of summer, whereas Templeton survived because he was too ill to have fun. Think about that. Because he had been told he'd fry if the sun so much as touched him, he was going through a vampire phase, walking around in a black silk cape and a pair of plastic fangs. His mom was home, but I was keeping him occupied in the dark shadows of their garage out of sheer fidgety nerves, the good kind. Yolanda was on the way. She had called just as she and her mother had set out to make the 1-hour drive from Denver. We'd been together for 18 months, and Yolanda had spent plenty of lazy afternoons in my apartment on Jackdaw Street. But she had only come out to her parents a year before and had wanted to give them some time to adjust to the idea before she officially moved in with me. She was right. They did need some time to adjust. About 5 minutes, maybe 10. I don't know how in life she ever imagined her parents could do anything but love her. The shock was how quickly they decided they were going to love me, too. Dr. and Mrs. Rusted were from the British Virgin Islands. Dr. Rusted, Yolanda's father, was an Episcopal minister and a Ph.D. in psychology. Her mother owned an art gallery in Denver. All you had to see was the bumper sticker on their Prius. Voting is like driving. R goes backward, D goes forward, to know we were going to be all right. The day after his daughter came out to them, Dr. Rusted took down the flag of the British Virgin Islands that hung from the pole on their porch and replaced it with a rainbow-colored pennant. Mrs. Rusted got a new bumper sticker for the hybrid, a pink triangle with the words, "Love is love," superimposed over it. I think they were secretly proud when someone egged their house, although they pretended to be steamed by the bigotry of their neighbors. "I cannot understand how they could be so intolerant," Dr. Rusted announced in his big, booming voice. "Yolanda babysit half the children on the street, change their diapers, sing them to sleep, and then they stick an anonymous note on the windshield wiper to say our child is a deviant and we should pay back all the parents of children she babysit." He shook his head as if disgusted, but his eyes glittered with amusement. All good preachers have a little of the devil in them. Yolanda and her parents had spent the summer in the BVI visiting the extended family and leaving me on my lonesome. Honeysuckle Speck, the only 23-year-old Joe Strummer lesbian look-alike on my whole block, student of law at the University of Colorado Boulder, fiscal conservative, lover of horses, and reformed user of dipping tobacco. The girlfriend made me quit. I hadn't had her in my arms in 6 weeks, and I was so caffeinated waiting for her and her mother to turn up this morning that I had the jitters. It was lucky for me I had the little vampire to fool with. There was a steel rack in the rear of the garage, a place to hang bicycles, and Templeton liked me to lift him up and turn him upside down so he could dangle from it by his knees like a bat. He said he went flying as a bat every night, looking for fresh victims. He could get down. I had positioned a mattress under the rack, and when he was ready, he would drop with an uncharacteristically athletic flip, landing on his feet. But he couldn't get back up without someone to lift him. By the time I heard the first crash of thunder, my arms were rubber from scooping him up and hanging him so many times. That first bang of thunder caught me off guard. I thought at first a couple of cars had collided out in the road, and I hurried to the open garage door, my nervous imagination already sketching a picture of Yolanda and her mother in a head-on. It is odd how much we want to be in love when you think about how much anxiety comes with it, like a tax on money you won in the lottery. But there weren't any wrecks in the road, and the sky was just as brilliant and blue as ever, at least from my vantage point. The wind was gusting strong, though. Across the street, over where the Comet Cult people lived, the breeze snatched at a stack of paper plates and scattered them across the grass and into the road. I could smell rain in that wind, or something like rain, anyway. It was the fragrance of a quarry, the odor of pulverized rock. When I leaned my head out and looked at the peaks, I saw it. A great black thunderhead the size of an aircraft carrier, coming up fast over the Flatirons like they sometimes did. It was so black it startled me, black with bruised highlights of pink in it, a soft, dreamy pink like a color you'd see at sunset. I didn't stare at it long, because at that very moment Yolanda and her mother turned onto Jackdaw Street in their bright yellow Prius, a velvet easy chair strapped to the top. They pulled up across the street in front of my house, and I started to walk over. Yolanda leaped from the passenger seat with a big scream. A gangly black girl with hips so round they were almost a parody of female sexuality, stacked on top of stork-like skinny legs. Yolanda was prone to screaming when things made her happy, and also doing this funny stomping dance around and around a person when she was glad to see them. She did it around me a couple of times before I grabbed her wrist and pulled her to me and, well, and patted her back in an awkward sort of hug. How I would regret that later. That I didn't snatch her around the waist and squeeze her against me and put my mouth on hers. But I was raised country. Anyone who so much as glanced at me would know me for what I was. One look at the strappy white muscle shirt and the trucker haircut and you'd spot me for a bulldog. On a public stage, though, I lost all my don't-give-a-fuck spirit, was embarrassed to touch or to kiss, not wanting to draw stares or to offend. The sight of her made my heart swell so full my chest hurt, but I hugged her mother more firmly than I squeezed my beloved. No last embrace, no final kiss. I'll live with that shame the rest of my life. We small-talked for a minute about the flight back from the British Virgin Islands, and I teased the girl about how much she'd packed for the big move. "You sure you remembered everything? I hope you didn't forget the trampoline. What about the canoe? You get that jammed in there somewhere?" But we didn't talk long. There was another reverberating boom of thunder, and Yolanda jumped and screamed again. That girl did love a good thunderstorm. "Yolanda!" Martina called from her lawn chair. Martina was the Russian stripper who lived downstairs with Andropov. She had a teasing, flirty relationship with Yolanda that I didn't much appreciate, not because I was jealous, but because I thought she liked to play friendly with the lesbians upstairs to rile her boyfriend. Andropov was sulky and overweight, a former chemist who'd been reduced to scrambling for driving gigs on Uber. "Yolanda, your lovely thing is going to get wet." "What did you say, Martina?" Yolanda asked, just as blithe and innocent as a child listening to teacher. "Yeah, you want to try that one again?" I said. Martina gave me a sly look and said, "Your chair, it get rained on. Big clouds make it all wet. Better hurry. You want to have a nice place to put your fanny." And she winked at me and picked her cell phone out of the grass. A moment later, she was chattering at someone in light, laughing Russian. It nettled me, listening to her lewd talk and putting on an act like she didn't know what she was saying because English was her second language. But I didn't have time to stew over it. The next instant, someone was tugging at my sleeve, and when I looked around, I saw that little Dracula had joined us in the street. Templeton had his cape flapped up over his head to protect his face from the sun, and he peered out at me from beneath its sleek black folds. He liked Yolanda, too, and didn't want to be left out of our unpacking party. "Hey, Temp," I said. "Your mom sees you outside. You won't have to pretend you sleep in a coffin." Right on cue, his mother shouted, "Templeton Blake!" She had materialized on the front step of their pleasant, butter-colored ranch. "Inside! Now! Honeysuckle!" This last directed at me, like it was my fault he'd gone wandering. She was just about quivering. She did not take her son's health lightly. And as it was, her concern for his well-being saved my life, too. "I got him," I said. "We'll get the chair inside," Yolanda's mother told me. "Leave it. I'll be right back," I told them. The last thing I ever said to either of them. I walked Templeton across the street. You could see that no one knew whether to go in or not. The thundercloud was a lone Everest of darkness in the immensity of the sky. Anyone could tell that it was going to pour hard for 6 minutes and then be clear and hot and nice again. But the next time the thunder boomed, a blue flashbulb of lightning popped off inside the cloud, and that got folks moving, sort of. Mr. Waldman, who had been reshingling, hung his hammer on his belt and started making his way down the pitch of his roof toward his ladder. Martina was off the phone and on the porch with her folded lawn chair, peering with a mix of curiosity and excitement at the darkening sky. That's where she was when Andropov slewed in, driving his black Chrysler too fast, shrilling the brakes, and then jumping out and slamming the door behind him. She smirked at him while he came steaming across the little scrap of yard. He was so red in the face that it looked like someone had shown him a photograph of his mother having sex with a clown. I nodded amiably to Ursula, who shook her head with a certain weary disapproval. It always distressed her whenever Templeton forgot to act like an invalid, and disappeared back inside. I led Templeton to the garage, scooped him up, and sat him on the stool at his father's workbench. The father was gone, had died when he got himself drunk and drove off the road and into Sunshine Canyon, but he'd left behind a manual typewriter missing the H and the E, and Templeton was writing his vampire story on it. He had 6 pages so far, and had already drained the blood out of most every wench in Transylvania. I told him to write me something good and bloody, tousled his hair, and started back toward Yolanda and her mother. I never got to them. Yolanda was up on the rear bumper of the Prius, wrestling with one bungee cord. Her mother stood in the road with her hands on her hips, offering her well-meant emotional support. One of the Comet Cult biddies was in the street, picking up paper plates. The fat girl working the grill squinted up at the Thunderhead with a sour look of resignation. Mr. Waldman perched on the top rung of his ladder. Andropov grabbed Martina by the wrist, gave it a twist, and dragged her into their apartment. That's what they were all up to when the storm hit. I took one step into the driveway, and something stung my arm. It was like that shock of pain and then the achy numbness you get after the nurse sticks a syringe in you. My first thought was that I'd been bitten by a horsefly. Then I looked at my bare shoulder and saw a bright red drop of blood and something sticking out of the skin. A thorn of gold. I sucked in a sharp breath and wiggled it free and stood there staring at it. It was about 2 inches long and looked like a pin made out of needle-sharp amber glass. It was pretty, like jewelry, especially all bright and red with my blood. I couldn't think where it had come from. It was hard, too, hard as quartz. I turned it this way and that, and it caught the weird pink stormlight and flashed. Mr. Waldman yelled, and I glanced around in time to see him slap at something on the back of his neck, as if the same horsefly that bit me had just bitten him. By then I could hear the rain coming, a furious rattling, building in volume. It was loud, a roar like 1,000 thumbtacks being poured into a steel bucket. A car alarm went off, the horn going blat, 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 somewhere up the hill. It seemed to me that the very ground under my feet began to shudder. It's one thing to be scared, but what came over me then was bigger than that. I had a sudden premonition of disaster, a sick flop in the stomach. I shouted Yolanda's name, but I'm not sure she heard me over the gathering rackety-tackety of the rain. She was still up on the rear bumper. She lifted her chin, looked into the sky. Templeton called to me, and the anxiety in his voice made him sound like the very small boy he was. I turned and found he had approached as far as the entrance of the garage, drawn by the roar of the oncoming rain. I put my hand on his chest and pushed him back into the garage, which is why he lived, and why I lived, too. I looked back just as the rain broke over the street, It crackled where it hit the blacktop and pinged when it hit cars, and some part of me thought it was hail, and some part of me knew it wasn't. The Comet Cult gal who was picking paper plates out of the road arched her back very suddenly and went all wide-eyed, as if someone had pinched her rear end. I could see pins hitting the road and spraying this way and that by then, needles of silver and gold. Up on his ladder, old Mr. Waldman went ramrod stiff. He already had one hand on the nape of his neck. The other flew to the small of his back. He began to do an unconscious jig on the top of the ladder as he was stung and stung again. His right foot dropped for the next rung, missed it, and he plunged, striking the ladder and flipping over on his way to the ground. Then the rain was coming down hard. The chubby woman at the grill still had her face to the sky. She was the only one who didn't run, and I watched as she was torn apart in a downpour of steely nails. Her crinkly silver gown was jerked this way and that on her body, as if invisible dogs were fighting over it. She lifted her hands, a woman surrendering to an advancing army, and I saw that her palms and forearms were stuck with hundreds of needles, so she looked like a pale pink cactus. Mrs. Rusted turned in a circle, keeping her head down, took two steps from the car, then changed her mind and went back. She fumbled blindly and found the latch. Her arms were prickled all over with needles, her shoulders, her neck. She struggled with the driver's side door, got it open, and began to crawl in, but she had made it only halfway behind the wheel when the windshield exploded in on her. She collapsed and didn't move again, her legs still hanging out into the street. The backs of her round, full thighs were a dense thicket of needles. Yolanda leapt off the rear bumper and turned toward me. She made a run for the garage. I heard her scream my name. I took two steps toward her, but Templeton had me by the wrist and wouldn't let go. I couldn't make him let go, and I couldn't go out there with him attached to me. When I looked back, my girl had been driven to her knees, and Yolanda... 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 The rain didn't fall for long. Maybe 8-9 minutes before it started to taper off. By then everything was covered in a blanket of glassy splinters, glittering and flashing as the sun came back out. Windows all along the street had been smashed in. Mrs. Rusted's Prius looked like it had been hit in 1,000 places by little hammers. Yolanda was on her knees, forehead touching the road, arms over her head, kneeling there in a hazy pink mist. My love looked like a pile of bloody laundry. A final drizzle fell with a crackle and some pretty ringing sounds, like someone playing a glass harmonica. As the clattering faded away, other noises rose in its place. Someone was screaming. A police siren wailed. Car alarms throbbed. At some point, Templeton had let go of my wrist, and when I looked around, I saw that his mother was standing with us in the garage, an arm around him. Her slender, intelligent face was stiff with shock, her eyes wide behind her spectacles. I left them without a word, wandering out into the driveway. First thing I did was step on some needles and shout in pain. I lifted one foot and found pins sticking from the sole of my sneaker. I pulled them out and paused to inspect one. It wasn't steel, but some kind of crystal. When I looked close, I could see that it had tiny facets, like a gem. Although where it narrowed to points, it was as thin as a hair. I tried to snap it in two and couldn't. I walked out into the road, sort of sliding my feet along to push needles ahead of me so I wouldn't get stabbed by any more of them. Yolanda was at the base of the driveway. I sank to my knees, ignored the stick of pain as my weight settled onto all those slim, glittering nails. Nails. The sky had opened and rained nails. The idea was settling upon me at last. Yolanda had wrapped her arms over her head to fend off the crystal downpour. It hadn't mattered. She'd been ripped apart, same as everyone else who hadn't made it to shelter. Her back bristled with needles, as dense as a porcupine's coat. I wanted to hold her, but it wasn't easy, as now she was a lump of brilliant, glittering spikes. The best I could manage was to put my face close to hers, so we were almost cheek to cheek. Crouched there with her was like being in a room she had just left. I could smell her sweet fragrance of jojoba and hemp, the products she used in the glossy whips of her dreads. Could sense that her light, sunny energy had just passed through, but the girl herself was somewhere else. I took her hand. I didn't cry, but then I have never been much of a crier. Sometimes I think that part of me is broken. Slowly, the rest of the world began to fill in around me. The whoop of car alarms, screams and weeping, tinkling glass. What had happened to Yolanda had happened from one end of the street to the other, had happened to all of Boulder. I found a place on Yolanda I could kiss. There were no quills in her left temple, and put my lips against her skin. Then I left her to check on her mother. Mrs. Rusted was face down under an avalanche of blue safety glass, stuck through with a hedgehog pelt of shiny nails. Her face was turned to the side, and there were nails in her cheek, a nail through her lower lip. Her eyes were wide and staring, bulging in a grotesque parody of surprise. There were nails in her back, bristling from her hip. The fob dangled from the ignition, and on impulse I turned the key to switch on the power. The radio sprang to life. A newsman spoke in a fast, breathless voice. He said that Denver was experiencing a freak weather event and that needles were falling from the sky and to stay indoors. He said he didn't know if it was an industrial accident or some kind of super hail or a volcanic event, but people caught outside were at high risk of death. He said reports were coming in from all over the city of fires and people killed in the street. And then he said, "Elaine, please call my cell and let me know you and the girls are inside and safe." And he started crying right on the FM. I listened to him sob for most of a minute and switched the car off again. I went to the rear of the Prius, opened the hatchback, and dug around until I found a quilt that Yolanda's grandmother had made for her. I took it back to Yolanda and rolled her into it, needles crunching and gritting underfoot. I meant to carry her up the stairs to my apartment, but no sooner had I finished folding her into her shroud than Ursula Blake appeared at one end of her. "Let's take her to my house, dear," she said. "I'll help you." Her quiet, forceful calm and the almost brisk way she settled into looking after Yolanda and myself brought me as close to tears as I would come that afternoon. My chest tightened with emotion, and for a moment it was hard to breathe. I nodded, and we lifted her together. Ursula took her head, and I held her feet, and we walked her back to the Blake house, that little butter-colored ranch with its tidy yard, or it had been tidy. The daylilies and carnations had been torn to rags. We put Yolanda down in the dim front hall, Templeton watching us from a few paces away. His plastic fangs had come out of his mouth, and he was sucking his thumb, something he probably hadn't done in years. Ursula disappeared down the hall and returned with another bedspread, and we went back outside to collect Mrs. Rusted. We put the two of them side by side in the foyer, and Ursula touched my elbow, just lightly, and steered me into the den and sat me on the couch. She went to make tea and left me staring at a television that didn't work. The power was out all over Boulder. When she came back, she had a mug of Irish breakfast for me and her laptop running off the battery. Her modem was down, but she was able to get internet through her cell signal. She put the computer on the coffee table in front of me. I didn't move till after dark. "Well, you know what the rest of that day was like, whether you were in Colorado or not. I'm sure you saw all the same stuff on TV as I saw on Ursula's generic black laptop. Reporters went outside to kick through the needles and record the damage. The storm had cut a 4-mile-wide swath down the mountain, through Boulder and into Denver. There was a skyscraper with every window on its western face smashed in and people staring out from 40 stories up. Abandoned cars littered the streets helter-skelter, all of them ready for the junkyard. Shell-shocked Coloradans wandered the lanes, carrying tablecloths and curtains and coats and whatever they could find to cover the corpses on the sidewalks. I remember one reporter yammering into the camera, and a dazed man stuck full of pins walked through the shot behind him, carrying a dead Yorkie. It looked like a bloody mop with eyes. This guy's face was a blood-smeared blank. He had to have over 100 nails sticking out of him. The operating theory, lacking any other credible explanation, was terrorism. The president had disappeared to a secure location but had responded with the full force of his Twitter account. He posted, "Our enemies don't know what they started. Payback is a bitch. Hashtag Denver, hashtag Colorado, hashtag America." The vice president had promised to pray as hard as he could for the survivors and the dead. He pledged to stay on his knees all day and all night long. It was reassuring to know our national leaders were using all the resources at their disposal to help the desperate. Social media and Jesus. Late in the afternoon, this one reporter found a guy sitting on a curb cross-legged with a square of black velvet spread out in front of him and delicate nails of all colors scattered across it. At first glance, he almost looked like one of these dudes you see selling watches on the street. He was studying his collection of pins with a jeweler's loop, looking at one, then another. The reporter asked what he was doing, and he told her he was a geologist and he was analyzing the nails. He said he was pretty sure they were a form of fulgurite, and she asked what that was, and he said a kind of crystal. By that evening, all the cable channels had experts saying much the same, talking about spectrographic analysis and crystal growth. Fulgurite had formed in clouds before. It happened whenever volcanoes blew. Lightning would flash cook flakes of ash into fangs of crystal. But there hadn't been any eruptions in the Rockies in more than 4,000 years, and fulgurite had never formed into such perfect little needles before. The chemists and the geologists couldn't come up with any natural process that would account for what had happened, which meant it had to be the result of an unnatural process. Someone had figured out how to poison the sky. So they knew what had hit us, but not how it could have happened. Wolf Blitzer asked one chemist if it might have been an industrial accident, and the guy said sure, but you could see from the nervous, scared look on his face that he had no idea. Then there were the plane crashes. 270 people died in one plane alone after it passed directly through the cloud. There were roasted bodies buckled into airplane seats bobbing in Bar Lake like corks. The whole tail section sat a few hundred yards away in the northbound lane of I-76, boiling with black smoke. Aircraft had come down all around Denver, crashes decorating an 80-mile radius and circling the airport. At some point I swam up out of my daze, the deep trance cast by scenes from the unfolding catastrophe, the same spell 9/11 cast upon us all. And it came to me that my parents might want to know I was alive. This was followed by another thought, that someone needed to tell Dr. Rusted what had happened to his wife and daughter, and that someone was going to have to be me. It was a Saturday morning, so he hadn't come to Boulder with them, but had remained behind to write the sermon for that evening's services. It was inexplicable that he hadn't called me already. I thought that over and decided I didn't much like what it might imply. I tried my mother first. It didn't matter we didn't get on. I don't care who you are. It's a human instinct to seek out your mother when you've skinned your knees, when your dog has been hit by a car, when the sky opens and rains nails. But I couldn't get through to her. Didn't get anything but an annoying squawk. Of course, it would have just been an annoying squawk if she answered, too. I tried my father, who was in Utah with his third wife, and didn't get him either. Just a long, staticky hiss. I wasn't surprised the cellular network was overloaded. Everyone was calling someone, and no doubt the relay towers had sustained a lot of damage. It was a surprise, really, that Ursula was able to keep us online. By the time I tried Dr. Rusted, I wasn't expecting the call to go through. None of the others had. But after 8 seconds of dead air, it began to ring, and then I found myself hoping he wouldn't answer. I still feel rotten about that. The idea, though, of telling him he'd lost his wife and daughter made my whole body throb with dread. It rang and rang, and then there was his voice, sweet and happy and kind, saying to leave a message and he would be so glad to hear from me. "Hey, Dr. Rusted, you better call me soon as you can. It's Honeysuckle. I need to tell you, just call me." Because I couldn't let him find out what had happened from a recording. I put the phone down on the coffee table and waited for him to call back, but he never did. We watched streaming video into the late evening, Ursula and I. Sometimes the video fragmented and froze, once for almost 20 minutes, but it always came back. I might have watched until the laptop battery died, but then the CNN stream went to video of a school bus turned over on its side, full of 6- and 7-year-olds, And that was when Ursula got up and closed her browser, shut her computer down. We had sat together on the couch most of the day, drinking tea and sharing a blanket tossed across our knees. At some point, I took Ursula's hand without knowing it, and for a while she let me, which couldn't have been easy for her. Maybe she'd been different before the husband died, but in the time I had known her, she could hardly bear physical contact with anyone except her son. She liked plants better, had a degree in agricultural science, and probably could have grown tomatoes on the moon. She wasn't much for conversation unless you wanted to shoot the shit about the best fertilizers or when to spray your fields, but in her own way she was comforting, even sweet. She took the blanket that had been across our legs and flapped it over me, as if we had already agreed I was sleeping on her couch that night, and she tucked me in like a seed in a warm, fragrant bed of earth. I had not been tucked in by someone else in years. My father was a no-good drunk who stole the money I made on my paper route and spent it on women of negotiable affections. He was hardly ever home when I went to sleep. My mother was perpetually disgusted with me for dressing like a boy and said if I wanted to be a little man instead of a little girl, I could put myself to bed at night. But Ursula Blake enfolded me in that blanket just as if I were her own child. It was so tender I half expected her to kiss me goodnight, though she didn't. She did say, "I am so sorry about Yolanda, honeysuckle. I know she was dear to you. She was dear to us, too." That was all. Nothing more. Not that night. It was good of her to offer me the couch, but when she was gone, I took my quilt and carried it out into the foyer. I had myself a little prey, kneeling beside the two dead women bundled there. I don't mind telling you, I had some pretty warm comments for the man upstairs. I said whatever was wrong in the world, there were a lot of good people in it, like Yolanda and Mrs. Rusted, and if he thought slaying them in a hail of nails served some kind of just purpose, I had a revelation or two for him. I said I was sure the world was full of awful sin, but riddling a pack of little kids headed to summer camp was going to eliminate absolutely none of it. I told him I was disappointed in his performance over the last 24 hours, and if he wanted to make it up to me, he'd better hurry up and get to smiting whoever had set loose the nail storm on us. I said Dr. Rusted had spent his whole adult life spreading the good news, telling folks about how to find forgiveness and live the life Christ wanted for them, and the least God could do was let him still be alive and tend to him in his time of mourning. I informed our father that I thought he was a damn bad sport for taking away the doctor's loved ones. That was a fine way to show appreciation for all his service. One good thing about being a butch queer is you already figure you're going to hell, so there's no reason not to give God a piece of your mind when you feel like it. After I was worn out cussing the Lord, my fatigue got the best of me, and I stretched up between Yolanda and Mrs. Rusted. I drew the quilt over me and threw an arm over Yolanda's waist. It's funny how tired I was, even though I hadn't done anything except stare at a computer all day. Grief is hard work. It'll run you down like you spent the day digging ditches. Or digging graves, I guess. Anyway, I had a good sleepy talk with Yolanda, curled beside her on the floor. I told her I would owe her the rest of my life for sharing her family with me. I said I was sorry like heck we weren't going to have more silly times together. I said it always made me feel good to hear her laugh, so loud and free, and I hoped someday I'd learn to laugh that way. Then I shut up and held her as best I could. I couldn't quite spoon against her. Even with her wrapped in a quilt, those hundreds of spines in her back made it impossible to cuddle. But I could drape an arm over her and put my thighs against the backs of her legs, and in that way I fell asleep at last. Only an hour or two passed before I opened my eyes. Something had changed, but I didn't know what. I peered blearily around and discovered Templeton standing just above my head, Dracula cape tossed over his shoulders and his thumb in his mouth. He hadn't been outside in days, and his face was corpse pale in the dark. The Lord of the Vampires, visiting with his colony of the dead. At first I thought Templeton was what had stirred me, but it was something else, and a moment later he told me what. "They're singing," he said. "Who?" I asked. But then I shut up and listened, and I heard them myself. A dozen sweet voices carried in the warm August night, all of them harmonizing to that Phil Collins song, Take Me Home. They'd been at it for a while. It was the sound of them, not Templeton standing over me, that had brought me awake. I peeked out the thick square window in the center of the door. It looked like the whole church of the seventh dimensional Christ were out in the night, dressed up in their shiny silver cowls and robes, carrying paper lanterns with candles in them. They had collected their dead, the three women who'd been out making lunch, and rolled them up in shrouds of metallic bubble wrap, so the bodies looked like monstrous burritos swaddled in tinfoil. The congregation had assembled in a pair of concentric rings, with the corpses in the center. The inner ring walked clockwise, the other ring marched in the opposite direction. It was almost lovely if you didn't think about how crazy all of them were. I picked Templeton up, brought him down the hall to his bedroom, and tucked him back in. His window was open a crack, and the song of the comet cultists came through clear and rich and full. For a pack of deluded and pathetic wastrels, they sure could carry a tune. I stretched out beside Templeton for a bit to see if I could settle him down. He asked me if I thought Yolanda's soul had gone up to the clouds. I said it had gone somewhere, because it wasn't in her body anymore. Templeton said his mother had told him his daddy was in the clouds looking down at him. Templeton said when he turned into a bat, he was always sure to go looking for his father in the sky. I asked him if he went flying often, and he said every night, but he hadn't spotted his father yet. I kissed his eyebrow on what Yolanda called his shiver spot, and he gratified me with a weak, happy shudder. I said, no flying anywhere tonight. Time for bed. And he nodded solemnly and said no more flying ever. He said the sky was full of nails now and it wasn't safe for an honest bat out there. Then he asked me if I thought it would rain like that again, and I said I didn't think so, because who imagined it would keep happening? If I'd known that night what we were all going to have to live through, I'm not sure I could have lived through it. I told Templeton no more thinking and got up to shut his window and said goodnight to him. I could only keep my smile on my face until I got out into the hallway. I stepped around the bodies of my own loved ones and let myself out into the humid, perfumed summer night. I meant to ask them to save their singing for some hour when people weren't trying to sleep, but as I approached, I saw something that irritated me even more than their harmonizing. Three hardy young men were at the edge of the lawn with Mr. Waldman, had dragged him across the street. They were busy winding him up in more of that shiny silver quilting. Elder Bent watched from a few paces away. His bald head was tattooed with a map of the solar system in black light ink. Mercury and Venus, Earth and Mars, Saturn and Neptune shone with a spectral blue-gray glow on his skull, while phosphorescent dotted lines showed the path they would follow around a goblin-colored sun. I'd heard he'd been a trapeze artist in a former life, and he had the physique to back it up, lean muscle, ropey arms. He wore a silver gown, like all the rest. He also had a large gold astrolabe hung around his neck by a gold chain, a decoration allowed only to the men. I'd call them a comet cult, but that's just a lazy tease and doesn't really sum up their beliefs at all. Most of them were middle-aged and visibly not right. There was one who had lost all three of her children in a house fire and would tell you with a smile that they hadn't died at all. They had crossed into a new, seven-dimensional form of existence. There was a man who put a 9-volt battery in his mouth sometimes to receive transmissions from various religious figures who he said were broadcasting from Neptune. He didn't hear their voices. He tasted their advice and ideas in the battery's coppery zing. One parishioner had a lazy eye and a tendency toward nervous spitting fits, as if she'd just gotten a bug in her mouth. Another of the devout had smiley face scars up and down his arms, the result of deliberate cutting. It made a person sad to even try to talk to them, the nonsense they believed and the embarrassing things they did. They were all of them waiting on the end of the world, and in the meantime, Elder Bent was showing them how to prepare their souls for the seven-dimensional existence that waited beyond death. He kept them busy studying star charts and fixing radios, which they sold at street markets on Saturdays. All of them believed that the final testament of the Lord would be written not in words, but as a diagram for some kind of circuit. I can't pretend I understood all of it. Yolanda had more patience with Elder Bent's basket of crazies than I did, had always been sociable with them when she ran into them on the street. She was better than me that way. She felt sorriest for the same people who pissed me off the most. I was pissed off then, and Yolanda wasn't on hand to calm me down. I crossed to the edge of their yard, where the three boys were getting ready to roll Mr. Waldman into their silver packing material, and I stamped on the edge of the fabric before they could flap it over him. The fellows who'd been wrapping him into his sci-fi shroud looked up at me with surprised faces. They were the youngest of Elder Bent's crew. The first was trim and tall, with a golden beard and shoulder-length hair. He could have played Our Lord in a performance of Jesus Christ Superstar. The second was a soft, chubby boy, the kind of dude you just know is going to have damp, hot little hands. The third was a black fellow suffering from vitiligo, so the dark of his face was mottled with patches of bright, almost startling pink. They all had their mouths open, as if they were getting ready to speak, but none of them said anything. Elder Bent shot up one hand in a gesture to be silent. "Honeysuckle Speck, what brings you out on this glorious night?" "I don't know what's glorious about 6,000 or 7,000 people getting torn to shreds between here and Denver. 6,000 or 7,000 people have stepped out of these sorry containers of the spirit," gesturing at his dead, "and have transitioned to the next phase. They've been set free. They're everywhere now, in 7 dimensions. Their energy, the background crackle of reality, the dark matter that holds the universe together. They prepare the way for the next great transmission. What I'd like to know is why Mr. Waldman is transitioning to your front lawn. What makes you think he'd want you to wrap him up in tinfoil like someone's leftovers? He is one of the forerunners. He goes to mark the way with so many others. It does no harm to honor his sacrifice." "He didn't sacrifice himself for the likes of you. Mr. Waldman wasn't part of your cult. He belonged to a synagogue, not a crazy house. And if he's going to be honored, it ought to be by the precepts of his faith, not yours. Why don't you leave him alone? Go drink some poison Kool-Aid and ride a comet, you vulture. You don't know a damn thing." He beamed at me, a tall, skinny geek with a glow-in-the-dark head. It didn't matter how you cussed him out. He always grinned at you like you were a charming scamp. "But I do," he said. "A damned thing is exactly what I know. The planet is damned, and I know it. I said the world would end on the 23rd of November, this very year at 5 a.m., and you see now, it begins." "What about when you said it was going to end in October, 2 years ago?" "I said the apocalypse would come on October 23rd, 2 years ago, and indeed it did, but it has been developing slowly. Few observers were attuned to the signs." "You also said the world would end in 2008, didn't you?" He finally looked disappointed in me. "The asteroid that was sure to hit us was turned aside by the combined will of 1,000 prayers to give us more time to perfect our minds for leaving the three-dimensional world. But the day and the hour are almost upon us now, and this time we will not turn the end aside. We'll welcome it with a happy song in our throats. We'll sing the curtain down on this life. We have been singing the finish for some time now. Maybe you could get back to singing it in the morning. Some of us are trying to sleep. And while you're at it, can't you sing something that isn't Phil Collins? Haven't we all suffered enough today?" "The words don't matter. Only the joy the singing generates. We store it like batteries. We are almost up to full charge and ready to go. Aren't we?" he called to his people. "Ready to go," they shouted back, swaying a little, staring at the starscape on his bald, bony head. "Ready to go," Elder Bent said placidly, lacing his fingers together across his flat stomach. The tattoos on his head glowed in the dark, but the stars on his knuckles had been printed there in plain black ink while he was in jail. He had served 2 years for what he'd done to his wife and his stepchildren. He had kept them locked in an attic for most of one summer, giving them a tablespoon of water to split in the morning and 1 nil a wafer to share in the evening, and making them map planetary orbits all day. If one of them sassed or didn't participate in their studies, the others were commanded to kick her back into obedience. One evening the wife escaped from him when he allowed the family outside to make star observations. The police threw him in the clink, but he wasn't there long. He got sprung on appeal, on account of his First Amendment right to practice his religion, which apparently included starving and abusing followers who didn't sing his hymns in the right key. Worse yet, the stepdaughters rejoined him as soon as he was free. They were devoted sisters of the faith now. They stood just behind him, slim and pretty beneath their hubcap headgear, the both of them giving me the stink eye. While Bent was blabbing, my attention had drifted from the three dopes crouched around Mr. Waldman. They had used the opportunity to begin wrapping him up again. I heard the crinkle of silver foil and stamped on the material once again before they could finish cocooning him. "You keep up with what you're doing, boys, and the apocalypse is going to fall on you a lot sooner than you think," I told them. They gave Elder Bent a nervous look, and after a moment he gestured with one long-fingered hand. The three young men stood and retreated from the body. "Do you think someone will sit shiver for him, honeysuckle? Mr. Waldman's wife is dead. His son is a Marine stationed in some foreign part of the world, and who knows when he will learn of his father's passing, given the current crisis. And when he does hear the news, if he ever hears the news, he may never make his way back to Boulder. The hard rains have only just begun to fall. More is coming, I assure you." "More is coming," repeated the boy who looked like the Christ. He fingered his own astrolabe necklace. "And we're the only ones ready for it. We're the only ones who know what's going to—" But Elder Bent gave a brisk wave of one long-fingered hand and shut him up. Then he continued, "Shouldn't someone honor his life? Isn't any ceremony better than none? Does it do any harm? If his son appears back in Boulder, the discharged flesh will be here to be mourned however he sees fit." He paused and then said, "Or you could take him. And how will you mark his passing, honeysuckle? Will you sit shiver for him? Do you even know how?" He had me there. I didn't like it, but I had my own dead to tend to. "Well, at least keep it down," I said lamely. "There's a child trying to sleep across the street." "You should sing with us. You shouldn't be alone tonight, honeysuckle. Come sit. Don't be by yourself. Don't be afraid. Fear is worse than pain, you know. Let go of yours. Your fear of the rain. Your fear of us. Your fear of extinction. It isn't too late for us all to love each other and be happy. Even here as the last chapter of mankind is written." "No, thank you. If we're all on the way out, I want to end my life sane, not wearing a sheet metal skirt and singing my way through the greatest hits of Phil Collins. There's such a thing as death with dignity." He gave me a sad, pitying smile and put his fingertips together in a gesture that made me think of Spock. And thinking of Spock made me sad again. Yolanda and I both had gay girl crushes on Zachary Quinto. Elder Bent bowed to me and turned with a rustle of his silver gown. It is hard to take a man seriously as a spiritual leader when he's swanning around in what looks like a prom dress made of Reynolds wrap. The chubby kid and the boy with vitiligo bent back to Mr. Waldman's body, but the one who looked like Jesus ran his fingers through his yellow tresses and took a half step closer to me. "If you knew what we knew," he whispered, "you'd beg to join us. We were the only ones ready for what happened today. A smart girl would think about that. A smart girl would ask herself what else we know that she doesn't." He sounded plenty ominous, but when he turned away with a dramatic swish, he stepped on a nail and yelped in a high-pitched voice that kind of ruined the effect. I watched him shuffle away, and then a movement, a flicker of light at the edge of my vision caught my attention, and I glanced around. It was Andropov, in his apartment on the first floor. He was standing behind the glass with an oil lamp, glaring out at us, glaring at me. It made my stomach go funny, the way he was watching. He lifted a sheet of plywood to the glass and disappeared behind it, and I heard him begin to wham away with a hammer. He was boarding up his windows, sealing Martina and himself off from the rest of the world. When I woke on Ursula's couch, the front room was flooded with strong, clear light, and I smelled coffee and warm maple syrup. Templeton stood over me, sipping espresso from a little mug. His Dracula cape flapped rakishly over one shoulder. "It was terrorists," he said without any preamble. "And they're saying there's a 60% chance of nails in Wichita. Do you want pecans in your waffle?" Ursula was in flannel pajamas, tending to a waffle iron set on her gas range. She had news streaming on her laptop again. You know it was on the news that morning. I'm sure you watched it, too. Letters had come to the Denver Times, the New York Times, and the Drudge Report. They were displayed, discussed, and disdained all morning long. Sirs, now is your day of ruin. A storm as big as Allah's fury is upon you. Blood will paint your roads. Bodies awaiting burial will cram your parks, vast farms for maggots. A million nails will rain upon you for your wars to rob Muslim lands of oil and your laws to bar Muslims from your racist nation. Soon you will fondly look back on 9/11 as a day of tranquility. The names of schools and churches scrolled across the bottom of the screen, like when everything is canceled for a big snowstorm. That's what I thought it was at first, a list of cancellations. It wasn't until I was eating my first waffle that I realized it was a list of places to bring your dead. They were saying at least 7,500 killed in the Metro Denver area, but law enforcement expected the number to go much higher by the end of the day. They showed a wedding, the bride in a red gown, all stuck full of needles. She was wailing and holding what was left of her husband. He had been torn apart, shielding her with his body. They'd been married for less than an hour. They'd been dancing in an outdoor pavilion when the rain began. The bride had lost her husband, both sisters, her parents, her grandparents, her nieces. On CNN, they had a chemist in the Situation Room. He began by repeating what we already knew, that the hard rain was made up of crystal fulgurite, what was also sometimes called petrified lightning. He said that while fulgurite could occur naturally, the crystals that dropped on Boulder and Denver were something new. They represented an artificial form of fulgurite that had to have been designed in a lab. Nothing else could account for the almost industrial perfection of the nails that fell on Colorado. He told Wolf Blitzer that it was possible, maybe even likely, that someone had seeded a cloud with it, perhaps using a simple crop-dusting plane, which supported the terrorist hypothesis. He added that the hard rain was doing things no fulgurite had ever done before. Instead of drizzling down mixed with rain, it absorbed water, using every bit of moisture it could get to power its growth. It didn't require lightning to turn to crystal. Any old static electricity would do. Wolf Blitzer said it was raining nails outside Wichita and asked his pet chemist if it was the same cloud that had rained nails on Boulder. The chemist shook his head. He said there might be a million grains of this stuff in the upper stratosphere and that it would collect in clouds like any kind of dust. Some would fall in needles and pins. Others would grow a bit, then fragment and break up, creating new grains of crystal to infect future cloud systems. Wolf asked him what that meant in simple terms. The chemist pushed his glasses up his nose and said that for all practical purposes, this might become a permanent part of the global weather cycle. This new synthetic crystal fulgurite was self-perpetuating, and it was in the atmosphere now. He said they'd need to do some modeling, but it was possible it might eventually make every rain cloud on Earth into a farm for crystal. He called that the Vonnegut scenario, that eventually ordinary rain might be a thing of the past. That was when Wolf seemed to forget that the cameras were pointing at him. He just stood there, looking sick. After a moment, he stammered that they were going to turn to the events unfolding in Wichita, and he cautioned parents against letting children watch. Until then, Ursula had been bent over the sink, briskly scrubbing out cups and pans and setting them to dry in the dish rack. But when she heard that bit, she told me, softly, it might be best to shut off the laptop and save the battery. And I knew she wanted to spare Templeton the sight of any more slaughter. I joined her at the sink and began to towel off wet glasses. In a low voice, I told her, Elder Bent says the world is going to end this fall. I think the scientist on CNN just agreed with him. I feel sick. Everything is terrible, and I don't know what to do. Ursula was quiet for a while, sponging the waffle iron. Then she said, In the days after Charlie died, I'd never felt so alone or scared or helpless. There is nothing that makes a person feel worse than helplessness. I was so angry I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't have him back. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't rewind what had happened and change it. I understand how you feel, Honeysuckle. I've already visited the lost and lonely place at the end of the world, and all I know is The only way to keep going is to do the things the people you loved would have wanted you to do. Try to imagine how Yolanda would have wanted you to use the time you've got left.